against humanity. They said that genocide, terror, and ethnic cleansing are just some of the crimes the regime is committing against Palestinians. Ministry further stressed Israel maintains the same racist and expansionist ideology that triggered the crimes committed during the Second World War.
The eighth round of talks aimed at saving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, between Iran and world powers, is steadily moving on. The Iranian delegation led by Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani has been in constant meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the deal, Britain, France and Germany, EU coordinator Enrique Mora, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. Progress has been reported on talks concerning Iran's nuclear commitments, but there are still differences when it comes to the removal of US sanctions and the Iranian demands for verification and guarantees. Tehran says it wants assurances the US will not withdraw from the agreement again or reimpose sanctions. European and American diplomats have been voicing their concerns about the pace of the talks. An advisor to the Iranian team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, says the only reason progress is slow is because the Americans are resisting the notion that they have to give up sanctions.
I think the most important thing is that the Americans and the Europeans have still failed to remove sanctions or agree to remove many key sanctions. That is simply unacceptable for Iran. If the Iranians are going to put a cap on elements of its nuclear program, there has to be a change, of a clear change in the eyes of ordinary Iranians with regards to the sanctions regime. It has to be broken. Iranians have to feel that the Americans and the Europeans no longer have their hands on their throats.
Russian lead delegate Mikhail Ulyanov, who's been in frequent meetings with the American team led by Robert Malley, recently tweeted, "It's time to learn the lessons from the failed maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration." Iran says although there's been significant progress on technical matters, differences, including those in the area of sanctions lifting, require political decisions mainly by the Americans that, if made, can lead to a durable agreement within a short period of time. Omar Lizki, Vienna.
Is the British Home Office abusing its powers by denying a former Guantanamo Bay detainee his citizenship rights? That is the accusation being made by Cage's outreach director Moazzam Begg, who announced he's taking legal action in the hope of winning back his passport.
I've been arrested under terrorism laws three times, and I've had my passport taken away three times, all without any due process, all without any access to legal recourse, and all by governments of Britain, both Labour and Conservative, and yet I have not been convicted of any crime, I've never had my day in court, and I have actually been declared innocent by the very police that arrested me in the first place.
Moazzam is a British human rights defender who was made famous when he was detained and tortured by the US in Afghanistan's notorious Bagram prison and Guantanamo Bay between 2002 to 2005. Ever since his return to the UK, Mr. Begg's passport has been seized three times in just 8 years, the latest being in September 2021.
I gave evidence at war crimes tribunals. I have given evidence to the International Criminal Court for Britain and America's role in torture and abuse there. And I've looked at Britain and America's role in the rendition program with countries they claim not to have good relations with. And that, I believe, has been one of the key reasons why I have been targeted.
Begg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter. This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
It's been 1 year since U.S. President Joe Biden took office after defeating his contender Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. He took charge of the Oval Office with lots of promises, but let's look at where he's standing after 365 days. For one thing, Biden promised to bring the coronavirus pandemic in the country under control after Trump failed to do so. At the moment, the United States continues to be the world's worst hit country by COVID-19, with more than 68 million cases and over 858,000 deaths. Infections in the past weeks have been jumping, reaching an average of over 800,000 cases a day. This is while, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 63% of the American population is fully vaccinated, and the numbers in southern states are much lower.
Look, folks, we're going to bring the Republicans and Democrats together and deliver economic relief for working families and schools and businesses.
These were Biden's words when he promised to get bipartisan cooperation to boost the U.S. economy and support the working class as, quote, the backbone of the society. Now we see that rift has not only widened between the two parties, but even the Democrats are divided over the issue, as some criticize Biden for not being bold or progressive enough with his agenda. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says Democrats are on the wrong path and need to make a major course correction, pivoting back toward the needs of working Americans. Sanders believes that in too many ways, the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class. Turning to foreign policy, Biden said last February that the U.S. would step up diplomacy to end the war in Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created humanitarian and strategic catastrophe.
But it looks like he couldn't keep that promise either. In December, the Senate supported Biden's $650 billion weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, even though Riyadh continues to target Yemeni civilians with airstrikes on an almost daily basis. Tensions between the United States and Russia have also escalated under Biden's presidency, especially more recently over Ukraine, with both Moscow and Washington targeting each other with tit-for-tat sanctions, while warning against a complete rupture in their relations. And regarding the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5+1 group of countries, Biden had this to say back in 2020, that his predecessor Trump had recklessly ditched the agreement, pledging that the U.S. would rejoin the deal under his presidency. But the Biden administration has been keeping the so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran in place and has even imposed more sanctions against many entities and individuals, showing no serious intention in getting back into that agreement. The latest polls suggest that Biden is entering his second year in office with the worst job approval rating yet. Affected by the COVID chaos, the messy and deadly U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in late August. Biden's approval ratings started relatively strong at 57%, but by September they plunged to 43%. A new poll by Gallup and Morning Consult finds only 40% of U.S. adults currently approve of the job he is doing, his lowest to date. All in all, in the eyes of both Americans and the world, Biden has had a very disappointing record for his first year in office.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
The war in Yemen continues at a ferocious velocity. The Saudi-led coalition has bombed dozens of sites, killing tens of civilians, in apparent response to the attack by the Yemeni army deep inside the UAE. Yet the Saudi-led coalition denied carrying out an airstrike on a prison that killed at least 70 people, including migrants, women, and children. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Saudi-led coalition hard-hitting bombing campaign is due to its failures on the battlefield and how vulnerable the UAE is when it comes to being targeted again. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have writer and political commentator Jim Kavanaugh joining us from New York. Also joining us is Yemeni activist and political commentator Hamza Shaban, who joins us from Toronto.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you gentlemen, and let me first start with you, if I may, Jim Cavanaugh. The Saudi-led bombing campaign, it has left dozens of civilians dead in one day, as opposed to the preceding bombings, which have killed, maybe on a smaller scale, but it's still happening either daily, every other day, or on a weekly basis at a minimum. Don't you think that whether it's 70 in one day or a couple here and there every other day, it still requires the UN to address it?
I certainly do. This has been going on for 7 years now, since 2014, longer than World War II. And this is a vicious war. And it was said a couple of years ago, this is the biggest humanitarian catastrophe in the world. And my president, when he was running for president, Joe Biden, said he would stop giving offensive arms to Saudi Arabia over this. And of course, flip-flopped on that and pushed through an arms sale in December for Saudi Arabia. So, you know, this is a nasty war. The Saudis have the advantage of, you know, these modern fighter bomber jet bomber planes. But the Houthis also have developed precision missile and drone capabilities that are worrisome and have hurt the Saudis and have this time hurt the UAE. And we shouldn't forget, at the beginning of this, when the Houthis came into the capital, they offered to have to let the ruling party join the government. And that was refused, and they ran off to Saudi Arabia and started this war. So we really have a nasty war that only continues with the good graces of the United States and Great Britain. The Security Council made a statement about the Houthi attack on UAE, but they didn't make a statement about the Saudi attack on a prison. What the heck are they doing there? And the UN Secretary General did. But, you know, they've kept their hands off of this because they don't want to tie Saudi Arabia's hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at what reaction the U.S. has had on this. Hamza Shaban, the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, he has said all parties to the conflict need to de-escalate and abide by their obligations under international humanitarian law. Coming from the U.S. that provides arms to Saudi Arabia and the coalition. What's your reaction upon hearing that from the U.S. Secretary of State?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me speak today with you. Definitely, like, if the U.S. thinks that the parties in Yemen, represented by Ansarullah or the government in Sana'a, or in the U.S. and UAE, and Saudi coalition need to de-escalate this, then they definitely need to start stop arming Saudi Arabia and UAE and providing them with arms so that de-escalation actually takes place and, the whole war stops. But when we see what's happening in Shabwa province and in Marib, what's happening is that UAE and Saudi Arabia continues to fund and arm the fighters who are fighting with them to continue taking more places. So, if there are no practical actions taking place in ground, then definitely whatever the U.S. Or U.K. or U.N. says does not mean anything. There needs to be practical steps if the U.S. is really serious about de-escalating the war in Yemen.
I'd like to refer an instance that happened just last week, Jim Cavanaugh, about Saudi Arabia and how it accused Iran of a false narrative that has been leveled against Iran time and again by Saudi Arabia. And it had to deal with this footage, which turned out to be from a documentary of a U.S., I guess, invasion of Iraq back in 2003. It accused Iran of being supportive or providing these ballistic missiles and besieged Red Sea port city of Hodeidah. You have Saudi Arabia coming out, making that accusation, and then coming out later and admitting to it being false. Spokesman of the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen, Colonel Turki al-Maliki, admitting to this. So how do you take Saudi Arabia's word when it accuses Iran or for any other instances of it trying to lead down a narrative that's to its advantage?
Well, of course, you shouldn't take Saudi Arabia's word. I mean, the United States lied for 20 years about Afghanistan, and people knew it. They said it. They reported it a couple of years before the war ended. This was all a bunch of lies. So you shouldn't take it. You know, you shouldn't take anybody's word. You should take Iran's word. People should look at the evidence. They should see what's going on. And, you know, there's also, this is a war. People are going to get help from various sides. That's what happens. And the United States, nobody has any less right to support the Houthis than to support the factions that Saudi Arabia supports. So these kinds of, you know, silly, phony videos and proof that are offered all the time that turn out to be not proof at all, but just, you know, lies and fact-checking. But it's really all kinds of beside the point. We have to end this war. Your previous guest said, we have to de-escalate, we have to disarm, and we have to have pressure from the major governments in the world who are keeping this going to do that.
How is that going to happen, Hamza Shehbani, when the governments around the world, if we're talking about some of the Western ones like the UK, France, and the US, continue to provide arms and sell arms to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE and to the coalition, whatever's left of it? As a matter of fact, who is in this coalition that we keep talking about?
In 2015, when it started, Saudi Arabia said that there were 20 countries. But in reality right now, there are only two countries left that are in the front lines, Saudi Arabia and UAE. But they're also backed by Western governments like US, UK, even Canada, France, and a bunch of other countries. But these countries, they're benefiting economically from selling arms to Saudi Arabia and UAE, but they're also pushing them towards hell, because right now the war in Yemen is different. It's not like how when it started in 2015. Right now, the Yemeni military have the capabilities and the willingness and the ability to hurt Saudi Arabia and UAE, especially UAE. UAE is a fragile country. Their economy is very fragile. They cannot take or stand the ballistic missiles and the drones that the Yemeni army have promised to be sending very soon. A few other ballistic missiles or drones will definitely send a very strong signal to the investors in the UAE to leave the country, to the expats who are 90% of the population in UAE. Almost 10 million people there in UAE are expats. When these people feel that UAE is not a safe place anymore, they will flee and leave UAE. So I really think that these Western governments, yes, they're benefiting economically from the war in Yemen, but they're also pushing UAE and Saudi Arabia towards hell, because right now it's different. Yemeni people can defend themselves, and they can also hurt these countries.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the UAE, if we can here. Jim Kavanaugh, where the latest coming from the Ansarullah fighters in terms of a warning is that foreign companies need to leave the UAE. It's unsafe there, they have said. In a veiled threat of revenge attacks, we, quote, advise the foreign companies in Emirates to leave because they invest in an unsafe country and the rulers of this country continue in their aggression against Yemen. So if I'm sitting there in some palace in the UAE, I would really think twice about this. So are they thinking twice and wanting not to get engaged, but they're being pushed to, maybe? Or what is the thinking behind them still engaged? Even though they have said, if you want to look at the record, that 2 years ago they announced their official withdrawal.
Yeah, they withdrew their ground troops. And then recently, but what they do is they fund and support these militia, which are essentially jihadi militia. They don't want to put their own troops in there. As what your previous guest said previously is absolutely correct. This is a very dangerous situation for Saudi Arabia and UAE. These are fragile regimes, ultimately. And if they start getting hurt, you know, and they were hurt. Look at them. I think it was 2020 when the Houthis hit those Saudi oil facilities, and they were pinpoint hits. So there are now, and they cannot hold territory. They don't want to put their forces in there. That's why they rely on airstrikes. That's what they're going to do. They were losing the battles of Marib. The ground troops they're going to use are these militias that they're going to pay for, mercenaries essentially. But, you know, Saudi Arabia got into this MBS thinking this was going to be an easy win and it'll pump up his image and the Saudi image in the region. And it's turned out to be exactly the opposite. And the longer this goes on, the more fragile those regimes are, the more likely those regimes are going to be hurt in serious ways.
There's another case here, the attack that took place on the UAE, Hamza Shaban, that I'd like to ask you, and that is the way that Israel came out, apparently in a rescue attempt, where the Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, said, quote, "We stand ready to offer you, the UAE, security and intelligence support in order to help you protect your citizens from similar attacks," further saying that I've ordered the Israeli security establishment to provide the counterparts in the UAE with any assistance. Now, does this mean that Israel is thinking of either becoming more involved in this war or directly maybe involved in this war militarily?
I think there are, you know, two points to address here. The first one is that I think Israel is trying to blackmail UAE, because we also, last year when there was a war between the Palestinians and Israel, Israel could not defend itself. They could not stop the missiles coming outside of Palestine striking Israel. How can they save UAE right now from this war? And we all know that the capabilities of the Yemeni military is way more advanced than what they have in Palestine. This is the first thing. Second thing is that I think Israel is also worried right now, because the fact that the Yemeni army could target Abu Dhabi means that their missiles and their drones could also reach to Eilat port in the occupied land of Palestine. So this is also worrying for the Israelis as well. Now, Israel has been involved in this war in an indirect way, but it seems that the role in the coming days might be more direct and more obvious, which is also going to cause threat to themselves, because as Sayyid Abdulmalik al-Houthi has warned Israel 2 years ago that if they're getting involved in this war, then they should expect that Yemeni people would defend themselves, and they would target some strategic sites inside Israel.
Indeed, and there's another angle to why Israel may be interested, Matt, in this, Jim Kavanaugh, and that is, I'm going to refer to another statement here by the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in which he said, "Israel is committed to working closely with you, the UAE, in the ongoing battle against extremist forces, and we will continue to partner with you to defeat our common enemies." Now, who can Israel be referring to when it says that, other than Iran?
Nobody. It's that's what it's referring to. It's referring to Iran. They see a victory of the Houthis as a victory for Iran. You know, and again, to the extent to which Iran is supportive of, in some way or another, of the Houthis, then that's going to be something that does benefit.
Well, you know what? I'm asking this question, Matt. I'm asking this question, Jim Kavanaugh. Sorry to jump in. Is because I'm looking at the fact that Israel is going to play the UAE to try to come in through this window to get at Iran somehow, one way or another, trying to push the UAE, or maybe give ultimatums down the road. The UAE maybe not realizing this, because obviously Israel wants to get at Iran in any shape or form.
But it also works for the UAE and for the Gulf monarchies, who are also feel threatened by Iran. So really, they're trying to turn this into a multi-state alliance again against Iran. And any resistance forces in the region are going to be blamed on Iran. That's what's happening now. And it's the case that Iran is the country that gives the most support to these resistance forces. And but you know they're independent forces. They're not controlled by Iran. And you know if they get some support, some kind, well, good for them, frankly, from my point of view. But you know, and Israel, but Israel wants to pump up the Iran threat. Definitely, they want to use this to stop the JCPOA from being reinstated. They want to use it to maintain. They want to maintain their conservative Gulf monarchies also. And they're afraid of what would happen if, you know, there were problems. Look at what happened in Iran back in the day, the revolutionary Yemen back in the day. You know, that would unleash forces of popular movements and resistance that the Israelis don't want to have appearing in the region.
Hamza Shehman, Iran has come out based on the most recent attacks that were heavy, causing a number of civilian casualties, saying that there's a lack of serious determination to advance the political settlements in that country, that obviously what's happening is going to lead to the destruction of the country and instability across the wider region. Why do you think there is a lack of determination for political settlements?
I think Saudi Arabia and UAE know exactly that any political settlement is coming would mean that Ansarullah or the government of Sana'a right now would be part of it. And they will have the majority there because they are right now expanding in many areas. They are the most powerful Yemeni party right now in Yemen. So the dread of them is absolutely, not something attainable at this point. For them to, so that's why they tried to advance in Shabwa and Mar, because they thought that they can actually make them weaker and then go for a political settlement. But this doesn't seem to be working for them very well in Yemen right now, and it's actually hurting them because the longer they stay in this war, the more they could be hurt in their countries.
All right, let's look at within the U.S. Jim Kavanaugh and what the Democrats have done just in the past 24 hours. They have said to Biden, you need to clarify the U.S. role in the conflict. And basically, the Congressman Peter DeFazio making this push. Jim Kavanaugh, are you with us? Wow. Okay, he's not with us. So, Hamza Shehban, my question goes to you. You have some Democrats, in this case, Peter DeFazio is a congressman there, saying that Washington needs to offer more, needs to clarify its stance. My question to you is, well, how much clearer can Washington be if Biden just approved over $600 million in sales to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, see, the U.S. cannot hide from, they can't cover their role in the war in Yemen. They're very complicit in this war, and they need to be held accountable. They're the main or the biggest arm exporter to Saudi Arabia and to UAE. I think UAE has a very apparent and obvious role in this war, and it's their war in Yemen right now. It's not. I don't think it's Saudi Arabia's or UAE's war in the region anymore. It's U.S. war, because if you think about it, yes, if U.S. really cares about Saudi Arabia and UAE and their stability and their safety, they need to stop arming them and selling them weapons, because this is only getting back to them. This is only giving back to the U.S. with economic benefits. But down the road, these economies might be hurt and hurt badly to a point where they might not be able to defend themselves anymore. So I truly believe that, U.S. and other Western governments, they don't really care about Saudi Arabia and UAE and their safety. But it's more for them. It's just a game where they sell them weapons, they get money, but they don't really care about their future and their safety.
All right. Well, we do have Jim Kavanaugh back. Jim, I'd like to go back to September of 2021, where the U.S. came out with a stance on Saudi Arabia and removed these missile defense systems and Patriot batteries. It was announced back in September of 2021. Why did the U.S. do it or take this step at that point when it's still obviously actively involved in one way or another for the security of Saudi Arabia?
I'm not sure, frankly. I think maybe because they weren't working very well. But that's a very good question. And I think also it had to do, well, I'm really not sure why they did that in September 2021, because as you say, they don't want to stop selling. For the United States, a lot of these wars are just excuses to keep selling arms. And the Patriot, taking out the Patriots, maybe that was Biden just giving a nod to his promises to, you know, withdraw military aid from Saudi Arabia. And he did something like that, and he thought it wasn't going to be terribly important anyway, because as we saw, those missiles didn't prevent the attack on the Saudi oil refineries. So other than that, I really can't tell you. But the United States seems to be, and I think they are, I disagree a little bit with the other guest here, I think they are concerned about Saudi Arabia. They don't want Saudi Arabia, they don't want these conservative monarchies to disappear and to be replaced by any kind of popular democratic revolution. They don't want that. Now, they're not as concerned about Saudi Arabia as they are about Israel, that's for sure. And they're not as concerned about Saudi Arabia maybe as they're concerned about selling a lot of weapons. But there's an important point for the United States in maintaining these conservative monarchies in place throughout the Arab world.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you. Jim Kavanaugh from New York, writer and political commentator. And Hamza Shaiban, thank you. Yemeni activist and political commentator, who spoke to us from Toronto. Thank you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitarpe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Democrats fear they are losing white swing voters over racial politics. Three studies suggest that the party's elite culture may be the real problem. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ryan Grimm, writer. This article is published under the heading, "It's Not Just White People. Democrats are losing normal voters of all races." Here's more. Research recently, a Democratic firm hosted focus groups with women in Virginia who voted in 2017 for Democratic Governor Ralph Northam, in 2020 for Democratic President Joe Biden, and then this month for Republican Governor-elect Glenn Youngkin. It was centered on suburban women, a group that pivoted significantly to the right in the governor's election. Consultant Danny Burfoot said that Anvil strategies called roughly 30,000 people in Virginia. Most didn't answer, but several hundred of them fit the criteria he was looking for. People who voted Democrat or Republican in the last three elections. Those people were called back and offered a $100 gift card if they would do a lunch hour Zoom and talk about why they voted the way they did. 96 women, a fifth of whom were not white, were broken into three different sessions. Barefoot sat in one of them and got permission from the funders to share codes and results. Focus groups are put together differently than surveys, which weigh the responses to reflect the population at large. While 96 respondents isn't enough for a robust polling sample, it's a chance to dig deeper into the views of a slice of the electorate. Virginia is about two-thirds white, and this sample was 79% white, so slightly whiter than the state at large, but not by a ton. 11% of them were black women, 6% Latina, and 4% Asian American. They came from around the state. Burfoot said he didn't ask about college education because what he was interested in was people who lived in the suburbs regardless of race or educational background. What Burfoot found is that while the women agreed with Democrats on policy, they just didn't connect with them. When asked which party had better policy proposals, the group members overwhelmingly said Democrats. But when asked which party had cultural values closer to theirs, they cited Republicans. The biggest disconnect came on education. Burfoot found that the school closures were likely a big part of their votes for Youngkin, and that frustration at school leadership over those closures bled into the controversy, pushed by Republicans around the injection of critical race theory into public school setting, along with the question of what say parents should have in schools. One Latina woman talked about how remote school foisted so much work on parents. Yet later, Terry McAfee, the Democratic nominee and former governor, would insist that parents should have no input in their children's education. As she put it, "They ask us to do all this work for months, and then he says it's none of our business now." The anger they felt at Democrats for the Commonwealth COVID-19 school closure policy became further evidence of a cultural gap between these working people and Democratic elites who broadly supported prolonged school closures while enjoying the opportunity to work remotely. Those with means decamped. Enrollment in Fairfax County schools dropped 5% and fell by 3.9% and 3.4% in Arlington and Loudoun counties, respectively. Those who were left behind organized parent groups to pressure the schools to reopen. Though the groups tended to be nonpartisan or bipartisan at the start, Republican donors and conservative groups poured money and manpower into them, converting them into potent political weapons that blended anger at the closures with complaints about Democratic board members prioritizing trendy social justice issues, all of it aimed at the November elections. "They keep saying a strong return to school, but there is no details," said Sandra Davis on Fox News over the summer, co-founder of one large group called the Open Fairfax Public Schools Coalition. their attention is on their things, like their pet projects and social justice issues, and the kids have been left to flounder, and there is still no plan for fall. You will be surprised to know I am a Democrat, she said. I have tried to warn them that there is a bipartisan tidal wave coming their way. They don't look us in the eye. They don't write us back. If we can recall them one by one, there is an election in November. That fall, Davis cut an ad for Youngkin, citing his commitment to keep schools open as decisive. And while the group made a Democrat angry at Democrats, the face of its opposition behind her was a coterie of Republican operatives. The bulk of the group's financing came from End to America, a conservative nonprofit, and Republican gubernatorial candidate Pete Snyder. Its co-founder was a Republican who lost a 2019 race for school board, and the rest of its officers were Republican operatives too. A slick nonprofit named Parents Defending Education was launched in 2020 to help guide the local groups. Little effort was made to conceal who was behind it. A longtime coach network operative, Nicole Neely, was placed at the helm of the grassroots organization. Aside from Davis, nearly every mom and dad brought onto Fox News to complain about critical race theory held a day job as a senior Republican operative. It was the purest expression of the way Republicans have driven the fight over schools and then capitalized on it. The fear of public schools indoctrinating our children has been a GOP theme for race-based voters for decades. But in the wake of Trump's rise, the party watched in horror as suburban voters recoiled from Republicans into the arms of Democrats. Casting about for an issue that could win some of them back, recall that this is a game of margins, not absolutes, the party landed on the schools. Around the U.S., the conservative media apparatus, unrivaled by Democrats, gave air cover to the schooling issue, handing local activists language to use, a story to tell, and the resources and platform to tell it. Tactic was even more potent in Northern Virginia, where many professional Republican operatives and lobbyists live. In Loudoun County this November, McAfee outpaced Youngkin 55% to 44, but Biden had beaten Trump there by 62% to 37. Youngkin's showing was only 11,000 votes fewer than Trump 1 year earlier, while McAfee notched 50,000 fewer votes than Biden had. While Biden carried Fairfax by 42 points, McAfee only took it by 31. That the GOP didn't make even bigger inroads given their heavy investment in the issue may be the one silver lining for Democrats who, witnessing a dishonest AstroTurf campaign take shape and get twisted beyond all recognition on Fox News, decided, perhaps understandably, but to their later regret, to ignore the question. After McAfee's debate gaffe, in which he delivered up the perfect sound bite to Youngkin, I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. It took weeks to respond, initially not recognizing the danger. Everybody clapped when I said, McAfee insisted later. Even where Republicans spent heavily against outmatched Democrats, they made only marginal gains in school board races. But if the issue continues to go uncontested, their luck may run out. National Democrats have no coordinated response yet, leaving school board members unstaffed, underfunded, borderline volunteers hung out to dry, with nothing to rely on but mainstream media assertions that there is actually nothing to see here.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.